Welcome to another episode of In the Name of Service, a podcast committed to sharing the untold stories of those who selflessly serve. Each episode features an interview with men and women who have been called to a variety of service-focused roles, such as the military, law enforcement, ministry, volunteering, and more. You aren't likely to know the names of the individuals you meet here, but our hope is by the end of our time together, you'll not only know their stories, but possibly be inspired to write your own in some way. Humble in nature, but strong in character, these everyday men and women showcase what it is to truly be a servant. We're glad you're here. Now here's your host, Dr. Barb Thompson.
Thank you so much for joining us for another inspiring episode of In the Name of Service. I'm your host, Dr. Barb Thompson. I've spent my career working with military and law enforcement units, conducting in-depth interviews with individuals hoping to earn their place on high-risk, high-performing teams. In most cases, they've already spent years of grueling physical and mental work just to get the chance to serve and sacrifice more. And that type of selflessness is special, and I feel worthy of recognition. While each person's story is unique and every path to service different, their goals seem similar, to do something bigger than themselves, to make an impact, to make a difference. And these difference makers were the catalyst behind this podcast, and it's my privilege to share their stories with you. So today I get to introduce John Daly. He's so well-rounded and has all these different talents, but you grew up in the military, but you are now an author and a coach. You still hold a full-time job as a trainer. You've published a book. You've got another one coming out. You're doing all these things. And I want people to know about it. I want people to hear about your story and how all those things came about. If you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Thanks, Barb. Well, first, I'm honored, truly honored to be on here with you today. I've been looking forward to it since the first conversation that we had before Christmas. But as you mentioned, my name is John Daly. I have been told that I am required to say that the views I express are mine alone and do not reflect the opinions of the United States Special Operations Command, the Marine Corps Special Operations Command, or Department of Defense, or anybody else. All right, they're only mine. But let's see. I grew up, knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a Marine, and whether it's, you know, certainly parts of that were about service, parts of it were about just doing really cool stuff. Parts of that were just being enamored of the Marine Corps. Certainly parts of that were that I was just a voracious reader as a kid and read all these stories of kind of the awesomeness of, you know, the military, particularly in World War II and Vietnam and so on. I grew up in a tiny little town in Virginia, kind of on the, where Virginia, West Virginia and Maryland come together. And, certainly another, you know, driving force was getting out of that little town. You know, I just kind of knew there was so much more to see. I think one of the gifts that I was given in huge quantities, you know, by my parents and from birth was just curiosity, right? You know, I just really always wanted to, experience everything that was sometimes to my own detriment, but, you know, there's so much to see and learn and do and people to meet, and credit a lot of that with my desire to join the military. And so right out of high school, I went, you know, straight to boot camp. I'd known I was joining for years since I was a little kid, but, graduated like 2 days later. I was on a bus to Parris Island, South Carolina. And, you know, it's tough. I mean, there's no way around that. Boot camp is a really tough, life-changing experience, but I kind of recognized that I loved it. You know, I loved everything about it. The kind of tight-knit, unity, the mission, the purpose, the fact that you're always, you know, kind of pushing yourself to be better than you were, not to let anyone else down. And so that kind of carried on throughout my career. I had just opportunities to kind of move into, you know, more specialized units, to sniper units, and then into force reconnaissance units. And then in 2003, the Marine Corps was told that it had to form a unit that was assigned to Special Operations Command. And I was really fortunate. I couldn't kind of believe my good fortune that I was selected to be one of the team leaders for that organization. So I've really, you know, spent 21 years on active duty, just long ball hitters, you know, the kind of people that you love to be around every day, the kind of people that make you love to get up and come to work every day. And since retirement, I've kind of stayed on. I wouldn't leave. So they gave me a job at MARSOC, leading the training and education branch. So for the last over 16 years, I've had the opportunity to do that. Still get to, you know, still excited to wake up because I still get to show up to work with long ball hitters and have some role in helping train those guys and gals. So I'm super excited. And I have a pretty awesome life.
I think so. You mentioned, I want to go way back, if that's okay with you. You mentioned that you grew up in a small town in Virginia, which hits home with me right now because we moved, you know, my husband recently retired, and we moved to a teeny tiny town in Virginia. So I'm getting that very rural feel. And I think the curiosity part that you mentioned really stands out to me. What do you think are some things about your upbringing, either experiences or relationships that shaped you in, you know, kind of put you on the trajectory that you've been on in your life?
Yeah, definitely. My father was a hugely instrumental in that. He was, could join the Navy right out of high school. Didn't love it. You know, he's, you know, during the Vietnam era was on a sub tender. And, you know, did his duty, did his 4 years and got out. He loved the experiences, you know, and so he would tell stories about, you know, being in the Pacific and being in Hawaii, here and there. And that was a big part of it, knowing, my grandfather had fought in Europe in World War II. I had an uncle who had been in Vietnam and in special operations. And so just kind of all of these stories coupled with the fact that my father was a big, you know, avid reader. And we had just bookshelves of, kind of all of the books, the things that he'd grown up reading, kind of the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and books about, you know, Tarzan and Zane Grey and just all of these incredible books of people having incredible adventures. When you're reading those things and you're in a tiny, tiny town where there's you know, not much ever happens, you know, you just realize that there's so much more out there. And there's absolutely, you know, benefits to living in a small town. There's a lot of that I still kind of live in a small town, and there's a lot of that I enjoy now. But yeah, at that time, you know, as a kid, I was like, man, I've got to get out of here. I've got to see all of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I just found, this is an aside, but I think it's cool that you mentioned the Hardy Boys, because I found this like set of Hardy Boys books. It was on sale at our library, and I take the boys like every week, and they were like a quarter a piece. I'm like, I'm buying all of these, and I'm just setting them on his desk. My older son, he's 10 now. And so when he's up late at night, man, I hope he has some of the same experiences that you have. He already crazed that adventure. So I love that. That you mentioned
those are the greatest. I went through at the time, I believe there was, or at least my father had about 30, and they were really old, you know, the initial version. I think he still has them, but, I would just kind of read all the way through 30 and then start back at one and just, you know, keep doing that. They were always having, you know, these exciting adventures, and that really drove me, I think, to, you know, always look out for the, you know, what's next. What's the next cool thing I can do?
You have had the privilege of being in the military during a historic time, a war like no other. Looking back on your service, and I know this is a ridiculously like blanket type of question, but because of all you've done and how long you've been serving, but what do you believe, kind of reflecting on your service, was your greatest challenge or most difficult experience?
That's there's a lot of ways we could go with that one. I had plenty of challenges I've said this a lot. I'm an entirely average, you know, or, you know, in some cases, maybe below average, you know, in kind of height and strength, and, you know, speed, intelligence, guy. But I had kind of fueled by all of the, you know, this desire for adventure and curiosity. Like I always wanted to be with the, you know, with the big kids, whenever there was playing going on as a kid, you know, I didn't want to play with the kids my own age. I wanted to play with the, you know, the fifth graders or the eighth graders. And, you know, joining the Marine Corps, same thing. I'm like, man, I want to be in the next, you know, next best unit, you know, the next, toughest thing. I want to prove myself to these guys. And, yeah, when you're wildly average, that's tough. Swimming for me was the first real hurdle that I had to cross in the Marine Corps. I had grown up with, we had a pond, streams, and it was expected that I would take off on my own and jump in it. And I could, you know, I thought I could swim because I could, you know, make my way, you know, to safety from one end of the pond to the other. But, you know, when we started taking, you know, physical screenings and they're like, hey, you know, crawl stroke or, you know, side stroke. I'm like, I didn't know any of those, right? I knew how to kind of dog paddle. I never had any formal swimming instruction. So that for me was, and I had, you know, when I realized that and when, you know, you're surrounded, treading water, passing breaks, things of that nature. And then, you know, I realized that I have a fear of water, which I think most people, you know, do. But that, you know, that recognition kind of hit me, of course, when I was being pulled out of the pool after passing out. And it's kind of a defining moment. You can either give in to that and say, you know what, I'm not going to do all of the things that I want to do because I can't overcome this hurdle. Or you can say that, hey, everything that I want is on the far side of fear. All right. And I think, although I don't know that it really clicked in my head at the time, I was the first, you know, when this happened, I was going through infantry school. So I'd only been in a brief amount of time and we had the opportunity to try out for recon. And I didn't make it because of that. But I passed out and the guy that pulled me out sat me down and was like, hey, man, you know, we really, really like the fact that you were willing to go until you passed out.
Oh my but goodness.
We really, really need people that can swim. So, you know, go do something else in the Marine Corps and then come back. And that was, you know, that kind of, I think, kind of set a benchmark for me that, hey, you know, you can always do more than you think you can do. You're always capable of more. And, you know, even if you're average, you know, or you think you're average, you know, there's like this, there's some spark of greatness like in all of us. And we just, you got to find it. You've got to find something to fuel it. And then you got to recognize that you'll never find it if you can't get past fear.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's so good. Hmm. Was there anything that you did practically? Like, how did you know that already as a young man that fear would always hold you back if you didn't take that other stance?
I don't know that I articulated it quite that clearly in my head, but, you know, I've spent a lot of time since then thinking about it as part of that curiosity. I think that, you know, I'm like, anytime I come up against a wall, you know, I've got to figure out a way to get over it, around it, under it, through it. And that I knew that, you know, my inability to swim was, you know, preventing me from all of the cool stuff, you know, and the only way I was going to get through that was to, you know, A, find somebody to help me, you know, you know, cause it's kind of hard to really learn strokes and things like that on your own. And then you know, keep after it. And, you know, I don't know that I've ever. I mean, I think there's like an innate fear of water in most of us. All right. So I don't know that I've ever totally, beaten it, but I've been able to, you know, beat it back, right? You know, push it back to allow me to do the things. I mean, there's a lot of the things that you do in special operations that I don't love, you know, jumping out of a aircraft at,
right, also 25, a little 30,000
feet. Yeah. I'm not, I don't feel compelled to go jumping on the weekends, right? I'm like, I did it for work. You know, I have gone recently back into scuba diving. Yeah, the water, that was really it symbolized a lot more than just the water. You know, I think once I realized that, hey, this thing is preventing me from doing the things I want to do. And the only way to do it is to get over that. Then I kind of use that as a template for other challenges that, you know, you're definitely more capable. All of us, you know, are more capable than we give ourselves credit for.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? I mean, that's a great lesson in and of itself. And it sounds like you learned that one early. Do you feel like there were other really, great lessons that you learned from your time in service?
I think most of them kind of revolved around that idea that mm-hmm. you know, as humans, we have so much latent potential. I think a situation that kind of really drove that home and really ignited like some of the curiosity that led me into the training people was I was, and I may have told you this, but I was on 9/11. I was in Darwin, Australia in a bar. We were on deployment and, you know, watching soccer was on television and, suddenly switched to the towers. And we knew then that we were kind of the closest. So we were by November, we were in Afghanistan and December, it was December 2001. I came in 87. So all of that time I missed the Gulf War. I was in Argentina working at the embassy. So I missed out on that. Somalia, they were, you know, I wasn't in town for that. So, you know, December 2001 was the first time I got, you know, really into a kind of a close up gunfight. The experience of kind of all of the things that go through your mind, the reactions, kind of watching how people perform. I've, like I said, the curiosity kind of leads to an analytical side of me. And, you know, the fact that I've read so much about it, and a lot of the information then was related to, you know, FBI studies on reactions to combat, what happens. I think, you know, on killing and on combat were books out at that time. And so,
great resources.
Seeing that up close and just being fascinated by the time distortion, the auditory exclusion, all of these things that I'd read about and recognizing them in me and in the Marines that I was leading on a road, you know, outside of Kandahar, you know, it's kind of set me on this like quest to understand how we perform during high stress situations and how can we train people to better operate in those environments. So to me, that's just hugely fascinating. And that translates, of course, to all forms of stress, right? In some cases, to kind of post-traumatic stress, you know, to people, things people are experiencing, you know, well post-combat. So I think that was, I forget the question. I may have gone off on a tangent, but that was definitely a learning experience that shaped my future, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I love it. Did you share these thoughts at the time with other people?
I did. Interestingly, I was a platoon sergeant, so I was, you know, they kind of had to listen to me. But after this gunfight, the next day I sat down with each guy individually and kind of went through. I'm like, hey, did you experience, you know, kind of time distortion? Did you experience like slow motion time or fast motion time? Did you, you know, and it was very, very interesting. The kind of my findings of my non-scientific research study was that almost everybody, you know, shared the same experiences that I did, or at least most of them, you know, auditory exclusion, perceptual narrowing, all of these things. There were one or two guys who were not as, who hadn't been in our unit nearly as long and kind of had the opposite effect. They kind of, you know, rather than everything moving very, very slow, they experienced everything moving too rapidly to make good decisions.
Wow.
So it was really kind of hit home to me that, and everybody was, of course, they thought I was weird, right? You know, why are you asking me these questions? But, it really kind of showed that, you know, in stressful situations, regardless if it's combat or not, you will default to your level of training, right? You're not going to rise to the occasion. So, you know, it's imperative, you know, if we want to overcome fear, you know, we've got to, you know, train as realistically as we can. We've got to prepare ourselves as well as we can. And if, you know, as leaders, you know, or bosses in any, you know, we have that responsibility.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and storytelling is so powerful. You know, that's why I was curious about if you had shared your thoughts with your team at the time, because, you know, you kind of forcing them, and you did, which is incredible. I don't think that was a practice that was taught at that time. I mean, other than, you know, kind of like outside of the whole AAR type of thing. But taking the time and honestly just like caring enough about the individual to sit them down one by one and talk through that experience. I mean, that's something that, like you said, even for a couple of them, they were kind of frozen in that fight or flight. They wanted to flee, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm just wondering about how well that must have prepared them for the next situation, because they had already processed and kind of been forced to process that one.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's really one of the keys, that the whole reason that we have an AAR process, or supposed to be. I think a lot of times it gets bastardized and misused. But, you know, if we can sit down and process the things that happen, particularly in stressful situations, I haven't read it in a history book, but I don't know if it was in Stephen Pressfield, but there's this idea that the Spartans had this time, like they called the morning time or the crying time or whatever, the post battle, where they would just sit down and no one who was not there, you know, was allowed to come in. It was just their time to grieve and mourn and kind of tell a story, whatever it was. And then, you know, the expectation was that, hey, when the sun comes up, you need to be ready to go again. So right. I think that's beneficial, you know, cognitively, right? Just learning what worked, what didn't,
yes.
But
yes.
Also emotionally.
Yes, agree. So you are a great storyteller, and you are telling stories in multiple ways through multiple mediums right now. Let's start with, if you will, just like what catalyzed you to start doing some of those things. And if you could tell us about your book and how that type of teaching and storytelling came about for you.
So I think, you know, ever since I started reading books, you know, the next step was writing stories, you know, as a kid. So I kind of, on one, you know, hand, was always preparing myself to be a writer. I've never been a great, you know, personal storyteller. You know, there's people that can tell a story and keep you captured. I'm, you know, much better if I can take a little time and write it down. You know, through my Marine Corps career, I wrote, I stuck to after action reviews and reviews of equipment and proposals and white papers and a few articles in Marine Corps tactical magazines and things of that nature. But when I retired, I had been able to complete a bachelor's degree in Homeland Security Studies right before I retired, using tuition assistance. So I had not tapped into my GI Bill. I had thoughts, like everybody did, of becoming a Homeland Security consultant of some sort. But when I retired. Nowadays, you're able to give your GI Bill benefits to your children or to your wife. I retired just before that began. So I was, one thing I knew for sure was that I was going to use every dime of the money that I had coming to me. So, I started with a liberal arts master's degree because it didn't require a GMAT or any sort of testing to see if I qualified for it. So, it's just by luck, I really was able to turn that almost into a literature degree, and just reading a lot of classes on different types of reading, poetry, which I really wasn't terribly into, fairy tales, just these random courses, literature based. And I had a couple of great professors during that encouraged me to write. And, when I finished that degree, there was the encouragement to apply for the Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program at University of North Carolina in Wilmington. And that's one of the best, it was like a top five writing program. And for somebody who'd never really written, you know, anything, didn't think I had a chance, but I was like, hey, you guys believe in me, I'll at least submit an application. And whatever reason, they decided to let me in. And that was really instrumental. One of the first classes I had, I was making a comment and I said something about real writers. I'm like, well, you know, real writers would do this or that. And one of the other students was like, took great umbrage to that and was like, hey, you know, everybody in here considers themselves to, you know, as a real writer, you know, you included, you know, and unless you, you know, that's, and I was like, you know what? Yeah. I'm hugely thankful to all of my, you know, classmates, there that kind of allowed me to see myself as a writer.
Yeah.
I was a situation, I mean, I was older than most of them, considerably older than a lot of them. But I had just crippling, like, self-doubt, you know, imposter syndrome, like I didn't belong there, which has been a thing, you know, throughout my career, you know, which I don't think is always a bad thing. But so the conclusion of that degree path was that you have to have a book completed. And I'd written a fiction, a novel that really didn't have much to do with the military. And that, that's on the shelf. You know, I'll pull that one back out. But I met an incredible lady who introduced me to her agent, and her agent had, you know, she shared some of the personal essays that I'd written about my time in Iraq. And yeah, he was like, hey, you know, let's turn this into a book. Let's get you a book deal. And he did. So that's been the process.
That's incredible. What do you want people to take away from? Well, first tell us the book and a little bit about what it's about and what you'd like for people to take away from it.
All right. So the book is a memoir, and it really there's a little bit of back and forth, but really chronicles the time between 9/11 and the establishment of this special operations unit. It was called Attachment One, the first Marine Corps unit assigned to SOCOM. And then through the early establishment of the Marine Special Operations Command, the Marine Raiders. So it's just my take on that. You know, when you, and it's just called Tough Rugged Bastards, which was, you know, has a couple of meanings, and you kind of get it throughout the book. But our commander, the guy who stood that up, was kind of famous for saying that today. I went Tough Rugged Bastards with strong backs and hard feet. That was one of his like catchphrases. And so it's kind of in honor of him, but it's also, you know, I talk a lot about imposter syndrome in the book, you know, that I was trying to be one of these tough, rugged bastards that, and I didn't realize at the time that all of them were, you know, having the same kind of self-doubt every day.
Yeah, so important and really for all of us to hear.
That's what, and a lot of times I think we look at that as a bad thing. Imposter syndrome is, you know, something to be gotten over. But I really feel as though it was something that drove us all. It was, you know, every day we had to prove ourselves and prove that we weren't the person that we thought we were in the back of our head. So, so the book, when you write a book, the general recommendation is to kind of pick one person, right? An avatar or ideal reader, and write it for that person. You know, hopefully I didn't screw up, but I didn't do that. I really tried to write it for a civilian audience, because I don't feel that a lot of books, you know, there's a whole lot of kind of bravado and a whole lot of just full of acronyms that most people don't understand. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write a book that's very accessible to somebody who could sit down and read and say, hey, you know, this guy was, you know, arguably a tough, rugged bastard, but he was, you know, also a father, and also, you know, regretted decisions that he made. And he, he was, you know, questioned himself on a regular basis. So, but also I wanted it to, you know, to have some lessons if a young, you know, Marine or soldier, airman, sailor, you know, picks it up, or somebody who's considering a career in the military, you know, they could hopefully go through and say, hey, you know what, here's a little, you know, it's not a self-help book, but here's a kind of a tidbit that might help me. And then, you know, for people who are just interested in the chronology of it, you know, how these things came to be. You know, I tried to address all three of those requirements. Right? So hopefully everybody will buy it or buy multiple copies. That's the goal.
Yeah. You know, I love that, because even people have contacted me about this podcast, because there are a lot of military folks, because that's my background and that's mostly who I know. But civilians who've never served have said thank you for these stories. And I think it's really important that we do make them accessible to all humans, because there are universal lessons, just like you're talking about. So having the humility to take out the bravado and the acronyms, like, you know, everything about everything, and allow it just to be a book that's very helpful for a lot of people, is, I think, very meaningful. So.
Yeah, there's still a lot of action in it. A lot of, like, we had an incredibly eventful deployment.
Right.
But yeah, it's just not, you know, my, you know, a mile a minute of stuff blowing up everywhere. It's tried to just be a little kind of introspective, you know, as we were going back through things. And introspection obviously is a luxury of, you know, being this being 20 years now in the past. Okay. All right. So there's a lot of it when I was writing, and I try to be very careful about, you know, if writing a nonfiction book, you have to tell the truth. All right. But the truth can sometimes be subjective. There's the truth that the way I see it now, the way I saw it then.
Of course.
And I really tried to make that clear that, hey, you know what? I probably wasn't really dwelling on this ethical question at the time, but, you know, now I'm, you know, thinking about it.
Interesting. Yeah.
There's, since we were there during a pretty lot of kind of volatile times, right?
Yes.
We got there right after the Blackwater, it was the handful of Blackwater personnel who were executed, and then the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. So we were kind of right in that mix and pretty heavily involved in some of those things. So yeah, it's definitely, I'd have to remind myself that, you know, hey, I was probably pretty pissed, you know, at this time. I was probably, you know, seeking retribution. Now that I'm looking back on it, you know, I obviously see things through, you know, eyes that are 20 years older.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Like, that's only human, right?
And that's what a memoir is, you know, is kind of supposed to be about, right? Memory,
right.
You know, so.
Yeah. You still hold down a full-time position that's very important, training, you know, future operators, and you're doing some writing. You're really contributing to, I guess, like, my professional network of people. You're handing out these lessons in a relatable way. You continue to write pieces, and you have some speaking pieces. Like, how do you keep going? Like, how do you keep motivated during all of that? You know, when you're kind of having a tough day, or it seems like it's too much.
You know, there's a thing that's always a point of discussion with writers, that, you know, people will say that if you don't write every day, you're not a writer. And I'd say that's garbage. You know, if that were the case, then I certainly wouldn't be. You know, I'd go for weeks without. So I recently had a little YouTube video where I talked about this, you know, the idea that motivation is what I call the fun uncle, right? That kind of shows you up and takes you to Chuck E. Cheese. And it's great when he's there, you know, enjoy it when motivation shows up. But, you know, what the only thing you can rely on is discipline. And you know, making yourself do the things that you don't want to do is makes the things that you don't want to do easier to do. So, yeah, believe me, I get there are plenty of days when I get home from work and I'm not going to touch, you know, this or any other writing. But I feel like I generally do have the fun uncle around. I'm generally pretty motivated because you know, people have said that, like, wisdom is realizing that you don't know anything. You know, I think maybe I'm finally, you know, starting to get a little bit wise in my old age. But the ability to share some of the hard won lessons that I've learned, I feel like I have a responsibility to do that, and I enjoy doing it. You know, I get the good fortune of kind of being able to do it face to face with a lot of the Marines at work every day. And that really, about a year or so ago, I was like, hey, let me start writing some of this stuff down and you know, sending it out and on Substack and emails. And the response to it's been pretty good. And the selfish portion of that is that my agent, you know, highly suggested that I get, you know, establish an email list. So, you know, then I've got more people that I can tell about the book. So there's that, but I've found for me the requirement to produce, you know, an email at a particular time every single week, you know, is beneficial for me. So I find it really helpful. And so I decided it was so good, I'd start another one that comes out every week. I question the validity of that idea sometimes, but, you know, all in all, it's been fun. It helps me process a lot of these things as well. You know, I can spend my time, you know, on a run in the morning or going for a ruck and, you know, like, hey, what am I going to write about? How can I take this military experience and turn it into something that's applicable to everybody and something that's hopefully, you know, humorous, you know, or at least enjoyable to read.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you hearing back from people? Or, I mean, I'm assuming that you do sometimes.
Yeah, I do. It's been good. I haven't had anybody say, "Hey, man, you suck. Stop, you know, stop doing this." I get a lot of favorable comments. A lot of both from the military folks who are like, "Hey, you know, I kind of remember that the thing you're talking about, or I remember experiencing that, and I, you know, thanks for sharing it." From civilians who are like, "You know, hey, that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, the way that you're using this, you know, the idea of the levels of warfare, the strategic, operational, and tactical, to talk about like long range, mid range, and short range goals." And so I think it kind of resonates with people. And I think some people just, you know, people who have not been in the military have a, like you mentioned, this, they want to know, right? They want to know more. So if they can make, you know, a few connections, then I think a lot of them enjoy that.
Yeah. Yeah. If someone listening to you today, has kind of felt that urge to make a difference, to do something bigger than themselves, to serve in some way, but they don't know where or how to get started with that, what would your advice be?
Interestingly, this week I had the opportunity to spend the afternoon with Dakota Meyer, who's a Medal of Honor recipient, and we had met previously, and so he came to Lejeune, and I was hanging out with him for the afternoon, and his a great speaker, but he, one of the things he talked about was that there's people that get out of the military and feel like they've kind of lost purpose, right? And that's a huge, I think, segment, right? And then there's people that, you know, may or may not want to be in the military, but, you know, want to have a impact, you know, in the world. And what Dakota said that, you know, I think resonated with everybody is, you know, there are a million ways to make a difference, right? A million ways to make an impact. Having, you know, being in the military is great, but that's absolutely not for everybody. You know, being in law enforcement or fire or an emergency room nurse, you know, all of those things are critical, important, and they make a huge difference. But the guy who bakes bread, you know, if you do it really well, you know, it has a huge impact on your community. You know, I think the thing within coaching, what I really try to initially focus on is we've got to, you know, lift our head up and see, you know, as far in the distance as you can, you know, what do you see there? What do you want to see there? Where do you want to go? And, you know, what's the, you know, the farthest ridge line that you can identify? Do you want to be known as somebody who's curious, right? How can you use that to, you know, how can you make that your purpose, right? If you want to, like I said, be a bread baker, you know, how can you be the best bread baker there is, or, you know, shop owner or bartender, right? I mean, I think it really comes down to what Dakota talked about was, you know, you just got to look at yourself in the mirror every day and say, hey, am I going to be good or am I going to be bad? Yeah. And if you're going to be good, then you got to make decisions that are good. So I think that's the key to it, really, just saying, hey, how can I make myself better today? And how can I, you know, make the world a little bit better? So I'd say that there's, you know, millions of opportunities to serve, from, you know, reading books to kids or going to the animal shelter and petting unwanted dogs. I don't know. You know, there's, you know, being a good citizen really is what I think it boils down to. You know, if we're, you know, we're all in this together, you know, we probably disagree on a lot of things. You know, but what I think we could agree on is, man, if we all just work to make America a little bit better.
Right.
That's my little soapbox. Answer.
I love that. And there's always opportunity right in front of you. You know, people might hear from someone like you who has this amazing history, really, and think, like, when they try to see as long and as far as they can, like, that's not what they see. But it does build, you know, like, if you just look for the opportunities around you now, kind of like you said earlier, too, like, when that swimming wasn't working out for you, yeah, there was something internal to you that made you want to keep, like, that was driving you, but you also reached out to another person. And I think, yeah, we can't downplay the humility it takes just to say, like, hey, I might not know, like, what that long range goal is, but if I expose myself to a few people along the way, then that's going to become, like, more and more clear. Or you can get some ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, particularly, and I think now, you know, over the last, I've spent the last couple of years really trying to define, hey, what do I, what I call like my Southern Cross, right? What are the, the stars in the night sky that, that I can always look up and see and find, make sure I'm heading in the right direction. You know, a lot of times we talk about the Northern or the North Star, you know, what's your North Star? I think that we need to have more than one. And the Marine Raiders are, you know, we're kind of partial to the Southern Cross because of the, our history and lineage in World War II. But, so I think, you know, 3 to 5, you know, different people call them different things, massive transformative purposes, you know, whatever those are. And those should be something that, you know, you probably never ever reach, but you can always keep moving towards. But, you know, when you're, I think when you're younger than I am, you know, with our, you know, special operators, like as far as they can see in the distance is earning the title. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
That's all that they can focus on.
Right.
Effectively. And so that's what I talk, you know, that's all you need to worry about.
That's
you
right.
know, for the next 9 months until you achieve this. And the other kind of sticking with that analogy is that, you know, the further you get down into a depression, you know, in the ground, right, or depression in real, the less far you can see.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you kind of need to, you know, what is it I can see right now? And maybe that's, you know, one hill over, right? Or maybe that's, you know, the next tree. And that's one of the huge lessons learned in the military. That, you know, sometimes when your feet really, really hurt, you don't think you can go another mile and you have 20 miles to go. You don't have to go 20 miles. You got to go another step. All right. And then you go one more and get to the next tree, get to the next, clearing. And I think just, you know, using that, like Dakota talked about, barometer of, hey, you know, every decision that we make, James Clear, his book Atomic Habits, you know, every decision that you make is a vote for the person that you want to be.
Right.
So, hey, what kind of person am I saying that I want to be? And are the decisions that I make supporting that? And if we're making, you know, hey, what would a good citizen do, you know, in this situation? You know, I think if we kind of start erring that way, then we start, you know, it becomes easier, right? And then we can, we get a little, climb a little higher and we can see a little further. And it's just, it's compounding, compounding interest.
I love it. So where can people find you? What's the best way for them to find your book or your Substack, get a hold of you, etc.?
Okay, so a bunch of ways. My I have a couple websites. They're kind of under construction. The problem my son, the problem with having a son who's a kind of web designer, a successful web designer, is that he doesn't have time to work on my stuff. But definitely, the Substacks, I have one called Think, Read, Write, Repeat that's, really kind of just a lot of the stuff we talked about today is the kind of tagline for it is getting better, and that is at jdaily.substack.com.
Okay.
DAILEY. And then another one that's not for everybody, but it's, really just kind of based on the idea of using rucking, you know, throwing on a heavy pack and walking as physical fitness and mental toughness development. That's called rtfu.substack.com. It's ruck the fuck. And that's newer, but that's, you know, there's a lot of people that enjoy, you know, enjoy that, you know, rucking. So that's kind of growing. So that's a great way there. I'm on Instagram and LinkedIn and all of those places. So, and the book is available anywhere you buy books. It won't come out until August 13th, but it's you can pre-order it on Amazon or Books a Million, or it's produced by a company called Knox Publishing and distributed by Simon & Schuster. So it's anywhere you can buy a Simon & Schuster book, you can find it. And again, it's called Tough Rugged Bastards.
I've really appreciated your time and just want to thank you for making yourself available to us here and letting me ask you some funny questions. Thank you so much for your service and thank you for sharing it and continuing to share it. I think it makes a difference for me. It keeps me motivated, and I know that it's doing the same for other people. So thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed being with you today.
Everybody, thank you for joining us for another incredible episode of In the Name of Service. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like and subscribe. And of course, feel free to share with those you feel would like to be inspired. Have a difference maker in your life that you'd like to see featured? Reach out to Dr. Barb Thompson at inthenameofservice@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.